His claimed financial status has finally met its marital status. Bankrupt, she said the group will not avoid accountability or her office with the move. The NRA said Marshall Smith, a former top executive at 3M Company, will serve as chief restructuring officer. The group has formed a committee to study opportunities for relocating segments of its business operations to Texas or other states. In the meantime, the NRA's general business operations will remain in Fairfax.
European News Bulletin.
Hello everyone, we're coming to you from the British capital here in London. My name's Amina Taylor and we start with our top story. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has downplayed the international reaction following the arrest of Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny. Navalny was detained after arriving from Berlin on Sunday, where he was treated following an alleged nerve agent poisoning back in August.
We can see how they jumped at yesterday's news about Navalny's return to Russia, and we can see how gladly the comments, which replicate one another, are being done. They are doing so happily, as it looks like Western politicians view this as an opportunity to draw attention away from the deepest crisis the liberal development model has found itself in.
Navalny's detention was widely expected, as the critic of the Kremlin had violated parole terms from a suspended sentence dating back to a 2014 embezzlement conviction. Under the terms of his parole, he was required to return to Russia after his treatment in Germany, but this was delayed for over 2 months. Navalny will now serve 30 days in prison and will be required to continue abiding by the rules of his parole. Well, Mohsen Abbas, political commentator, has been watching this one keenly. And Mohsen, I mean, Navalny must have known that he would have been arrested on his return. Was this a nice bit of show for the Western audience here?
I think so. Alexei Navalny is simply a puppet within a sort of Western game of actually trying to disrupt and put Russia in an internal, if you like, issue. He does have a considerable following. Again, one has to beg the question how on earth he got such a massive following on social media. I mean, just an anti-corruption campaigner, really. That's all he was. But he's turned into this figurehead, which again is it smacks of color revolution style operations in the background to boost this individual, and of course this provides them yet another opportunity to really highlight him and to put the Russians under pressure. But of course, really the real backdrop to this is the downward spiral in Russian and European or Western relations ever since the Ukrainian Crimean interference by the Western regimes, and of course Russia's response to that has been also to put down the similar color revolutions they've been trying to orchestrate in Belarus, and at the same time this Alexei Navalny issue is thrown up as yet another quite comical, if you like, saga, which serves that kind of cyber warfare suppression of Russian, if you like, re-emergence, what with their support with China building up the Eurasian alliances, their re-emergence in Middle Eastern politics successfully and across Africa as well. This is troubling for the Western democracies, which actually Mr. Lavrov has pointed out is the fundamental problem. They're so insecure with their own performances in their own sort of neoliberal so-called democracies that they have to constantly be trying to find ways.
Indeed, and Mohsen, very quickly here, you touched on a couple of the things that you so wisely mentioned there, including the fact that this can be quite a distraction technique. But can you imagine Moscow trying to dictate the UK's terms here, which is essentially what the West wants to do with Russia?
It's unthinkable, because of course they do from time to time blame the Russians for interfering in the election processes of America. Even in Britain, they sort of intimated it with Jeremy Corbyn. So they do try to put these allegations on the Russians. They also, I mean, the Financial Times put out a whole article, I think a little while back, accusing the Russians of having relations with the right wing in Europe. So essentially saying that Russia is fomenting the right-wing movements across Europe, which is it's laughable, really, to the extent that the Russians won't have that degree of influence within sort of fascist-style politics, which opposes their kind of philosophy in the first place. But really, all of this is ultimately their fear that Russians' growing influence in Eurasia, with all of the recent Azerbaijan and Armenia. If you like, peace that they evolved, their relations with Turkey building up, say, the S-400, their relations with Iran and Syria, all of this is concerning the Westerners. Biden is coming in, and they've obviously fired a few salvos already now. NSA incoming Jake Sullivan.
Those are, in fact, pertinent points to watch, and we'll continue to do so. Mohsen, thank you, as always. Mohsen Abbas there for us. And we move to some other news now, because with infection soaring, governments in the United Kingdom and across Europe are desperately trying to get a handle on the pandemic through measures like national lockdowns and mass immunization programs. In Britain, more than 3.8 million people have already received the COVID jab, and in other EU countries, mass vaccination programs are underway. Saeed Poreza fills us in this update.
With only one way out of the pandemic, no building in Britain is being overlooked in a bid to vaccinate the nation. This church in northwest England, the latest experiencing its own conversion from church to vaccination center. One of 10 opening this week, as the government announced the rollout was headed in the right direction.
We've got the light at the end of the tunnel with the vaccine rollout. We just got to stay at home as much as possible, unless there are really strong, limited, exceptional reasons.
The government's aim is to immunize 15 million people in the high-risk group by the middle of next month and another 17 million by spring, when they're hoping to ease lockdown restrictions.
We are aiming to complete all of our residents in care homes by the end of next week. We're aiming to complete everybody over 70, all the clinically extremely vulnerable, and all health and social care staff by the middle of February.
But as mass immunization in the UK goes into overdrive, how are some other COVID hotspots in the continent faring? In neighboring France, a nationwide campaign to inoculate people over 75 has gotten underway, as officials seek to ease concern about deliveries of vaccines. Spain, too, has launched its inoculation program, while it tries to avoid a full-scale lockdown.
We do not contemplate at this time any home confinement. We overcame the second wave without home confinement.
Mass vaccination is also ongoing in other rich European countries, such as Italy, the epicenter of the pandemic in Europe, as well as in Austria, Norway, and Switzerland, where the fight to push down high infection figures is ongoing. Back in the UK, the latest measure, a closure of travel corridors. As of Monday, all arrivals in the UK will have to quarantine for 10 days and show proof of a negative test. The government is fearful new variants of coronavirus could derail the vaccine rollout.
We've seen rising numbers of infections of coronavirus, both domestically and internationally. We've taken the view that it's now the right time, as we're looking at the data, to take some extra steps.
Accused of moving too slowly in keeping COVID out, the British government is now desperate to stay ahead in getting jabs into people's arms and fast. And as for the rest of the continent, the race against the clock is on. Saeed Poreza, London.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we cover the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Ahmed Caballo will commemorate a very special anniversary, and one, dare I say, that would have passed many of us by.
Yes, so January the 17th was the 60th anniversary of what people are calling one of the most significant assassinations of the 21st century, and that is of Patrice Lumumba, the first democratically elected Prime Minister of the Congo. Now, the Congo, many people estimate to be the wealthiest country in the world based on the natural resources that lie within its borders. But according to the GDP, it's one of the poorest countries in the world. And that's because before Patrice Lumumba and shortly after Patrice Lumumba was assassinated, the wealth of the Congo has been used to enrich European powers and American elites. And that is why he was assassinated. So as the years have gone on, we found out that it wasn't only the Belgian authorities that were responsible for his assassination, but they were in cahoots with President Eisenhower, the CIA, and MI6, who all wanted to get rid of the man who wanted to nationalize natural resources and make sure that the workers in the Congo that produced the wealth that the Europeans and the Americans rely on were paid a fair wage for their work. And what's worrying about this is, on the day of its independence on June 30th, 1960, Patrice Lumumba made this very passionate speech. And some people say that it was this speech that made him a marked man, that made him be seen as a potential threat to Western interests.
Quick reaction and into the comments there, Ahmed.
Yeah, so you notice the Belgian king did not clap at the idea that the Congolese were no longer to be treated as second-class citizens or they would be paid a fair wage, and that was the reason. Now we'll get on to some of the tweets. Rover Q says, on this day, 1961, Patrice Lumumba, freedom fighter and anti-imperialist, was kidnapped and assassinated by firing squad. After urgent Belgian and CIA directives were issued, his body was desecrated and his legacy of national uplift in the Congo was shattered. He died at the age of 35. And one final point, his body was dismembered and put in sulfuric acid because they did not want the symbol of what he represents to live on long after he was killed.
All right, your next story.
This is an interesting one. So it was the number one trending topic in the United States, and it was after Donald Trump, or after Trump. And it was quite interesting to me because so many Americans are saying, after Trump, everything will be great again. It was great before. Donald Trump was a small interruption of how American politics, which was a great force for good in the world. But now he's gone, everything will get back to normal. Now we'll read a couple of these tweets and we'll get into some of my thoughts and analysis. So Untrump says, after Trump, I will have hope again. Jay Braps says, after Trump, I will channel my energy into healing from the abuse and trauma of his administration and get back to being a happy and healthy human being. Now, one of the problems with this thing that was trending is it doesn't spare a thought to the people of the global south whose lives were decimated by Barack Obama's administration, by George W. Bush's administration, and Bill Clinton's administration before that. Although Donald Trump has done many terrible things, 330,000 Americans have died because of COVID, that they do not seem to care or have any understanding of the true horrors of U.S. empire, the children in Fallujah that are born with birth deficiencies, the over a million dead in Iraq and Afghanistan, the predator drone strikes enacted by Barack Obama's administration. All those people are insignificant because the only problem in the U.S. system, in the eyes of those tweeting, was Donald Trump. And that is very problematic. Now we've got one final tweet by Nada. She says, after Trump, he'll be the first president in 152 years to skip his successor's inauguration. He'll be forever known as a one-term, twice-impeached loser for being the first president to have so many terrible first president awards. Tired of so much winning.
Well, we'll see pretty soon whether or not this rather rosy, tainted image is correct. Amin Kabbalah, thank you very, very much. And we move on to some other stories now, because the Israeli regime have advanced plans to build nearly 800 homes in settlements across the occupied West Bank. According to anti-settlement monitoring group Peace Now, Tel Aviv authorized the plans on Sunday evening in a last-minute bid of approval. This just a week before close ally to the Israeli regime, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Trump, leaves office. According to Peace Now, 90% of the settlement units lie deep within the occupied West Bank. Both the European Union and the United Kingdom have condemned the move, both stating that it undermines the prospect of a viable two-state solution. Now, Yusuf Al-Khalou, independent journalist, is with us from London. Yusuf, the application, the decision, these were all rushed through. Wasn't this about making the most of Trump's final days in office here for Netanyahu?
Yes, indeed, Amina. It is a house cleaning for Trump to finalize his promises to his friend in need, Netanyahu. I guess the green light which Israel enjoys is because of the impunity and the support, the green light given to Israel by Trump. So it's a matter of speeding, accelerating these settlements before Biden takes office. And we know that Netanyahu has been favored a lot by Trump's reckless decisions. And we know the story of Jerusalem leaving the embassy and not considering Israel's illegal occupation illegal anymore. So it's a house cleaning in my mind. And I think Palestinians, they do not really pin high hopes on the next president, Biden, when it comes to Israel's violation of international law.
Why do you think that is, Yusuf?
It's because the American administration has never been an honest peace broker, and Palestinians, somehow they have doubts about Biden's really if he's going to be like pro-democracy or let's say respects international law. But on the main side, Palestinians they demand Biden to restore the international system, to allow Palestinians to have their dignity, to pressure Israel to end its prolonged occupation. But as I said, doubts are high. And when it comes to the U.S. administration, the policy stays the same, but people come and go, different faces for the same currency.
Indeed, and you mentioned dignity there, but also health we should like to mention, because we've seen much being made of Israel rolling out its vaccine, yet Palestinians are on the sidelines still waiting. Briefly, Yusuf, your thoughts on that?
Well, Israel prides itself as a country that managed to vaccinate about 20% of its population. But unfortunately, the international regime, or let's say the international community, forgets that Israel occupies a large number of Palestinians under the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. And Israel hesitates, or let's say refuses, to allow these vaccinations to reach the Palestinian population, or at least to vaccinate Palestinian key workers or paramedics who transfer patients across checkpoints when it comes to the bandstands of the West Bank. And also, let's not forget the thousands of Palestinian political prisoners held in Israeli jails in crowded cells. And those vulnerable people, they risk the lives. Israel disregards the health of those people. Many of them, they've got chronic diseases. And we hear from officials in Israel that they do care about democracy, or let's say their fellow human beings. But we know from previous experiences, Israel considered Palestinians subhumans. And unfortunately, the world is watching. The WHO also pressures Israel to abide by the international law by allowing these vaccinations to reach Palestinians. But all these calls fall in deaf ears.
Same story, unfortunately, Yusuf. Thank you so very much. Now we move across to Italy, where the country's Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte has announced that Italy will enter into a new series of restrictions aimed at containing the resistance COVID-19 surge. Under the new plans, all non-essential businesses have been closed and non-essential travel between provinces barred. The opening of ski resorts has also been postponed for a second time. Italy's been operating on a three-tier set of restrictions, with red zones put on partial lockdown, allowing outings only for urgent reasons like work, grocery shopping, or the pharmacy. Now the new measures will stay in force until the 5th of March this year. Snowfall and cold weather conditions have disrupted land and sea traffic in Turkey's largest city, Istanbul, on Monday. Traffic was brought to a halt by a blanket of snow covering the city, with some cars stalled or skidding on the roads. The heavy snowfall, which is expected to continue into Wednesday, has prompted Istanbul's Disaster Coordination Center to issue warnings for citizens. The city will also be housing some 1,200 homeless people in hotels during the freezing conditions. Robert, in Lakesh, they're counting down the days until Joe Biden takes office. But what does this mean in terms of real-world politics right now?
Well, the story that we're looking at today is an intriguing one because, of course, Joe Biden has sworn to be a lot better than the previous president, still president right now, Donald Trump, when it comes to border control and immigration into the United States. But this story here is perhaps shining a light on what is to perhaps come. A Biden aide has told 8,000 Honduran migrants that heading to the United States, that they should turn back and that the border would not be open immediately to them. And on top of that as well, other people close to Joe Biden, the incoming Biden administration, have said that there will be changes taking place. However, they will not take place immediately. And so this will take quite a bit of time to come into effect. And what we're seeing is a reluctance to take in many people that Joe Biden has sworn that he would perhaps take in, or that at least he'd deal with it better. We do know, however, that Joe Biden was vice president under Barack Obama. Now, Barack Obama deported a lot more people than Donald Trump deported. And those infamous cages where children were being kept in the Trump years were actually built under the Obama administration, where, of course, Joe Biden was vice president. So a lot of people are calling into question as to whether Joe Biden is going to be that much better. There is a claim that this will change, but we're going to have to see how this all turns out.
And the reaction to this has been what, Rob?
There's been a mixture of reactions. Of course, as you can imagine, this story is whipping up a lot of tension, especially between Trump supporters and Biden supporters. The first commenting on this, we have here a Twitter user saying, hilarious to watch racist idiots go crazy over 8,000 people and claim Joe Biden is going to allow an invasion. In reality, Biden is doing the opposite of what he promised. It looks like he won't even consider letting them in. Then we got another one here from a, I suspect, Trump supporter, last beacon of hope, God bless America. That's their account. And they say, and so it begins because phony Biden told them they were welcome to break into America. Say goodbye to safety, jobs, and resources. The Biden looting begins. Migrant caravan in Guatemala pushes through border from Honduras, heading to the United States of America. A lot of fear-mongering there, as you could imagine.
And attached to this story, though a separate one, very briefly, just bring us up to speed with, well, the fate of some of those who protested in the summer demonstrations against the government in Beijing.
Well, this is a very interesting story to put alongside our previous one. That's the story of, specifically in this case, five protesters who are apparently prominent. We don't know their names. They haven't revealed their identities, who have are essentially seeking asylum inside of the United States. And they're being helped along by this organization based in Washington called the Hong Kong Democracy Council. Again, a lot of people are called into question, why would the Hong Kong Democracy Council based in Washington be helping these sort of people? We also know that the National Endowment for Democracy has been feeding these protests, which have been ongoing, as an attempt to get at the Chinese authorities inside of Hong Kong over a security bill that was drafted and, of course, was changed. So what we have here is an example of the United States looking to take in people with ease from Hong Kong. We know that the United Kingdom has offered for people in Hong Kong who were born prior to the 1997 hand back to Beijing of Hong Kong, that they would offer them citizenship now as well.
It is. And very briefly, give me your last tweet on this one.
So the final tweet that we have here is from some guy with opinions who says, "Let this sink in. Not a single protester has been killed by Hong Kong police in years of on and off protests. This despite them being so violent and having killed police. Democrats go crazy at what happened at the Capitol, but when it happens in Hong Kong, it's revolution and social media promotes it."
All right, we leave it there, Robert Inlakesh, and we leave you there. Stay tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Donald Trump is planning an early morning send-off event for himself at a military airfield in Maryland on Wednesday, 20th of January, several hours before his successor, Joe Biden, is inaugurated as the 46th U.S. president at the Capitol in Washington, D.C. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnists Joanna Walters and Martin Bellum. The piece is titled "Trump to hold early morning send-off ceremony on Biden inauguration day." Stay with us for more of Joanna Walters and Martin Bellum's article. Donald Trump is planning an early morning send-off event for himself at a military airfield in Maryland on Wednesday, just several hours before his successor, Joe Biden, is inaugurated as the 46th U.S. president at the Capitol in Washington, D.C. For his last presidential ceremony, Donald Trump reportedly wants an ostentatious military parade and an official armed forces farewell as the commander-in-chief, as well as a large crowd of supporters, selected backers, and current and former officials in his administration, and their guests at a huge red carpet event. But latest reports indicate that Trump, who is facing an impeachment trial in the U.S. Senate and a number of criminal and civil investigations, will not be afforded a big military send-off, just 2 weeks after a deadly insurrection at the U.S. Capitol building that followed his exhorting of his supporters to fight to overturn the election result. Invitations have been issued from the White House for an event taking place at Joint Base Andrews, the military base in Maryland used by Air Force One, at 8 a.m. on Wednesday, 20th of January, just 4 hours before Joe Biden will take his oath. Many details of the ceremony are not yet clear, although attendees will have to make a pre-dawn start and have been told to arrive by 7:15 a.m. at the latest, when temperatures are forecast to be below freezing. Attendees may not bring items including firearms, ammunition, explosives, laser pointers, or toy guns. In his last few hours as president, Donald Trump will fly to his private Mar-a-Lago resort and residence in Palm Beach, Florida, aboard the Air Force One jumbo jet for the last time in a presidential capacity, ensuring he and his wife Melania are almost 1,000 miles away from the White House and Capitol when Joe Biden takes over. Air Force One will then be at the disposal of Biden. Trump would have had to have permission from the Democrat who defeated him in the election to use it if he had waited to leave Washington until Biden was sworn in at noon on Wednesday. According to some reports, a 21-gun salute has been under consideration for the event at the Andrews Air Force Base, and officials are considering an elaborate ceremony that would have the feel of a state visit. Senior Pentagon officials reportedly told the security and intelligence news website Defense One that no military farewell was being planned for the commander-in-chief, unlike ceremonies in the past for Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, and Barack Obama. With the sun barely up at the start of an expected-to-be-chilly Wednesday, a minimal group of staff still left in a rapidly emptying White House will see off Donald Trump as he takes one last walk across the South Lawn to enter Marine One. The presidential helicopter for a short flight to the Andrews Air Force Base just a few miles away. Strict security arrangements in place for the inauguration following the 6th of January violence at the Capitol building have also limited the number of people who can attend the White House departure. 4 years ago, Barack and Michelle Obama hosted Donald and Melania Trump for tea at the White House before traveling to the ceremony to watch Donald Trump inaugurated as the 45th U.S. president. But Trump has made it clear he would become the only president in a century and a half not to attend his successor's inauguration, and only the fourth person in history not to do so, with the plans for his premature departure unprecedented. Vice President Mike Pence is attending Joe Biden's inauguration, but it is not yet known if he will attend Donald Trump's farewell at either the White House or Joint Base Andrews beforehand. Mike Pence traveled to thank troops in California and New York over the weekend as part of a farewell from the Trump-Pence administration, engagements that would have been expected to be carried out by the president. Donald Trump has not been seen in public since he traveled to the U.S.-Mexico border last Tuesday. In recent weeks, he has not visited the U.S. military and has not visited or spoken of healthcare workers overwhelmed at hospitals and vaccination sites as the United States coronavirus death toll approaches 400,000. The Bidens, meanwhile, may be able to see and hear Trump departing aboard Marine One as they are staying close to the White House the night before the inauguration. There is no word on whether Donald Trump will call Joe Biden or leave the traditional letter to his successor upon the Resolute desk in the Oval Office. Reports on Monday afternoon said that the Bidens would be greeted by the White House chief usher on Wednesday, whereas traditionally it will be the departing president and first lady who should be greeting. They also said Melania Trump will become the first modern first lady not to invite her successor for a tour of the private living quarters at the White House. Melania Trump will become the first modern first lady not to invite the woman who will replace her to the White House for a walkthrough of private living quarters on the second and third floors of the White House. Workers have already hung bunting that reads 2021 Biden-Harris inauguration from temporary stands across from the White House's North Portico, visible from the third-story residence, according to a CNN report. The cable news network CNN also reported that on the day the White House military office will ensure there are several nuclear footballs available. The heavy briefcase that is always carried near the president with codes to launch nuclear weapons in case of a nuclear attack. One such so-called nuclear football will reportedly travel with Donald Trump to Florida, and his codes will be deactivated by the time Joe Biden is sworn in at noon on Wednesday, when an aide carrying another nuclear football and working codes will then begin to shadow the new president. The invitation for Donald Trump's send-off specifies that face masks must be worn. Late last year, Donald Trump was criticized for hosting a series of indoor and outdoor events at the White House where social distancing rules were not observed and face masks were not worn by attendees, and guidelines were not enforced, leading to several high-profile COVID cases with the gatherings described as super spreader events.
As-salamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The reason why the Islamic Republic is opposed to negotiating with the U.S.
This is part of a televised speech delivered on July 31st, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Eid al-Adha.
In a few years, we will be needing at least 20,000 to 30,000 megawatts of electricity generated by nuclear energy. These needs cannot be fulfilled in the space of 6 months, 1 or 2 years. These needs should be satisfied in advance, and we have prepared the grounds for it. Despite the fact that we have suffered a great deal of loss because of the Barjam, the JCPOA, the essence is fortunately still there, and good and dazzling tasks are being accomplished in this regard. The enemy does not want this, though. The same is true of defense and missile areas. When the Americans say, "Let us negotiate," this is what they want to negotiate over. I strongly ask everyone to pay attention to this. Of course, I have repeatedly spoken about this, but I have to say it again because some people do not understand or pretend that they have not understood it.
Your light and love, all I see, your thing or I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
When the enemy says, "Let us negotiate," it means, come and sit at the negotiating table so that we will instruct you not to build missiles, which you have to accept, of course. If you accept their terms, well, you will be ruined as you have actually rendered yourselves defenseless. And if you do not accept their terms, there will be the same story. There will be more skirmishes, more sanctions, and more threats. This is what negotiation means.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah. All praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah. All praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Trump era leaves third biggest relative deficit increase ever and was notably piled up without launching a foreign war. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Alan Sloan and Cesare Podkal writers. This article is published under the heading Trump Debt to Overwhelm U.S. Economy for Decades. Stay tuned for the details, please. One of President Donald Trump's lesser-known but profoundly damaging legacies will be the explosive rise in the national debt that occurred on his watch. The financial burden that he's inflicted on U.S. government will wreak havoc for decades, saddling kids and grandkids with debt. The national debt has risen by almost $7.8 trillion during Trump's time in office. That's nearly twice as much as what Americans owe on student loans, car loans, credit cards, and every other type of debt other than mortgages combined, according to data from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. It amounts to about $23,500 in new federal debt for every person in the country. The growth in the annual deficit under Trump ranks as the third biggest increase relative to the size of the economy of any U.S. presidential administration, according to a calculation by a leading Washington budget maven, Eugene Stroll, co-founder of the Erwin Brookings Tax Policy Center. And unlike George W. Bush and Abraham Lincoln, who oversaw the larger relative increases in deficits, Trump did not launch to foreign conflicts or have to pay for a civil war. By the Trump administration's own description, the pre-pandemic national debt level was already a crisis and a grave threat. U.S. national debt has reached immense levels relative to the economy, nearly as high as it was at the end of the Second World War. But unlike 75 years ago, the massive financial overhang from Medicare and Social Security will make it dramatically more difficult to dig out of the debt ditch. When Trump took office in January 2017, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office was projecting that federal budget deficits would be 2% to 3% of gross domestic product during Trump's term. Instead, the deficit reached nearly 4% of gross domestic product in 2018 and 4.6% in 2019. There were multiple culprits. Trump's tax cuts, especially the sharp reduction in the corporate tax rate to 21% from 35%, took a big bite out of federal revenue. The CBO estimated in 2018 that the tax cuts would increase deficits by about $1.9 trillion over 11 years. Meanwhile, Trump's claim that increased revenue from tariffs would help eliminate or at least reduce national debt hasn't panned out. In 2018, Trump's administration began hiking tariffs on aluminum, steel, and many other products, launching what became a global trade war with China, the European Union, and other countries. The tariffs did bring an additional revenue. In fiscal 2019, they netted about $71 billion, up about $36 billion from President Barack Obama's last year in office. But although $36 billion is a lot of money, it's less than 1/750 of the national debt. That $36 billion could have covered a bit more than 3 weeks of interest on the national debt. That is, had Trump not unilaterally decided to send a chunk of the tariff revenue to farmers affected by his trade wars. Businesses that struggled as a result of the tariffs also paid fewer taxes, offsetting some of the increased tariff revenue. By early 2019, the national debt had climbed to $22 trillion. Trump's budget proposal for 2020 called it a grave threat to economic and societal prosperity and asserted that the U.S. was experiencing a national debt crisis. However, that same budget proposal included substantial growth in the national debt. By the end of 2019, the debt had risen to $23.2 trillion and more federal officials were sounding the alarm. Not since the Second World War has the country seen deficits during times of low unemployment that are as large as those that we project, nor in the past century has it experienced large deficits for as long as we project, Philip Sogel, director of CBO, said in January 2020. Weeks later, COVID-19 erupted and made the financial situation far worse. As of December 31, 2020, the national debt had jumped to $27.75 trillion, up 39% from $19.95 trillion when Trump was sworn in. The government ended its 2020 fiscal year with a portion of the national debt owed to investors, the metric favored by CBO at around 100% of GDP. The CBO had predicted less than a year earlier that it would take until 2030 to reach that approximate level of debt. Including the trillions owed to various governmental trust funds, The total debt is now about 130% of GDP. Still, the deficit growth under Trump has been historic. A stroll of the Tax Policy Center has done a comparison of every American president using a metric called the primary deficit. It's defined as the deficit minus interest cost because interest is the only budget expense that presidents and Congress can't control unless they want to do the unthinkable and default on the debt. A stroll examined the records of 45 presidents to see how the primary deficit had shrunk or grown relative to the size of the economy between the first and final years of each president's administration. Trump had the third biggest primary deficit growth, 5.2% of GDP, behind only George W. Bush, that is 11.7%, and Abraham Lincoln, that is 9.4%. Bush, of course, not only passed the big tax cut as Trump has, but also launched two wars, which greatly inflated the defense budget. Lincoln had to pay for the Civil War. By contrast, Trump's wars have been almost entirely of the political variety. Today, many of U.S. biggest and most rapidly growing expenses, especially Social Security and Medicare, are baked into the budget because of U.S. aging population. These outlays are slated to rise sharply. Stroll recently calculated that Social Security, health care, and interest costs are projected to absorb 122% of the total growth in federal revenues from 2019 to 2030. Had Trump done what he said he would do and paid off part of the national debt before COVID-19 struck rather than adding significantly to the debt, the situation would be considerably less dire. And had Trump done a better job of coping with COVID-19, the economic and human costs would have been greatly reduced. In addition to forcing Americans to reduce the proportion of the budget spent on the future to help pay for the past, there is a second reason that huge and growing budget deficits matter: interest costs. Bigger debt ultimately means bigger interest costs, even in an era when the Federal Reserve has forced down Treasury rates to ultra-low levels. The government's interest cost, including interest paid to government trust funds, was around $523 billion in 2020 fiscal year. That outstrips all spending on education, employment training, research, and social services, Treasury data shows. Interest costs are way below where they would be if the Fed hadn't forced rates down to try to stimulate the economy and mitigate the impact of the pandemic. Annual net interest costs are projected to double in 10 years and grow so large beyond 2030 that interest will become a driving factor in annual deficit growth, according to Peterson estimates. Trump was asked about this risk during a virtual discussion with the Economic Club of New York last October. If we have another stimulus bill out of Congress, are you worried that the entire amount of federal debt will be too large for us to pay off in a sensible way? Asked David Rubenstein, a private equity executive. Trump answered by falsely claiming that the U.S. was starting to pay off the national debt before the pandemic, and he claimed that future economic growth would let it do so. I think you're going to see tremendous growth, David, and the growth is going to get it done, Trump said. 2 months later, when Congress finally approved $900 billion of economic stimulus that is being financed with debt, Trump challenged Congress to spend and borrow even more. Then he went golfing.
Around the world with reporters.
Austria extends its third hard lockdown until the 7th of February, announcing a new requirement for everyone to use FFP2 or N95 masks in supermarkets and public transport, and extending the minimum distance rule from 1 to 2 meters. The announcement comes a day after thousands took to the streets of Vienna protesting the COVID restrictions. The right-wing FPÖ party, which supports the protests, expressed anger at the decision, warning that people would no longer understand the necessity for the measures and persist in civil disobedience. Officials maintained that they would do the right thing, notwithstanding how popular it will be.
The results of our consultations over the past few days make us anything but happy and also make us anything but popular.
Studies have now shown that the new virus variant first discovered in the UK has been in Austria earlier than was initially suspected, currently affecting around 10% of positive cases.
If the new variant replaces the current virus as the dominant strain, 5 times more cases of illness and death can be expected.
Austria's health minister says the country is currently in the most difficult phase of the pandemic and that the situation is very challenging, at least for the next 10 weeks till the end of March, when warmer weather and more vaccinations can help improve the situation. Around 600,000 people are expected to be vaccinated by then. The goal is to reach a 7-day incidence of 50 new infections per 100,000 people. That number is currently 130. But there's light at the end of the tunnel, Austria's Chancellor says. With the vaccination campaign underway, officials expect things to look more normal in April or at the latest in May. Homolesky, Vienna.
Faced with the dilemma of holding or postponing an election in the midst of a pandemic, politicians in Catalonia have chosen to heed health experts' advice to adjourn a February election as a surge in coronavirus cases threatened to overwhelm hospitals in what local media perceive as the third wave of the pandemic.
In the coming weeks, everyone needs to focus exclusively on the evolution of the pandemic and on the need to avoid the collapse of the healthcare system.
The pro-independence government picked May 30th as the chosen date for the next poll.
It's simply because that's when health experts believe the pandemic will subside and conditions will get better. It's the end of the cold season, the contagion will be reduced, and most of all, we are likely to have vaccinated a large part of the population by then.
All parties agreed to postpone the election, but the Socialist Party of Catalonia, the offshoot of Spain's Socialist Party leading the central government in Madrid, said the date was too far away.
What we object is that some have taken advantage of the legitimate fears about the COVID-19 to advance a different agenda. We believe that some parties seem to have taken into account what the polls say more than what the health data say.
Latest opinion polls show the separatists leading a majority in the 135-seat regional parliament, possibly passing the 50% symbolic threshold for the first time. But growing divisions between the two largest pro-independence blocs, led by Oriol Junqueras from jail and Carles Puigdemont from exile, suggest they may seek new alliances to form a new government.
With the vote on hold, the focus in Catalonia now is on the evolution of the contagion in the coming weeks and the progress of vaccination. There's a shared feeling that the more people get the vaccine, the safer the environment for in-person voting. Cusay Kadri, Barcelona.
Thank you.
Health systems in the EU are buckling under pressure from new coronavirus cases resulting from the holiday period. New variants are raising concern. Businesses remain closed. These have been identified as major challenges for the Portuguese government, which has just taken over the rotating presidency of the EU.
One of the first priorities is vaccination. Vaccination is the light at the end of the tunnel of this pandemic.